Good evening. Welcome. Thank you for coming to the first reading of the new year for our River Styx reading series, our 33rd season. Tonight we will be partnering with the St. Louis Poetry Center, longtime allies in the world of poetry, co-sponsoring lots of readers that we bring to town and events, and then tonight we actually get to feature readers from the St. Louis Poetry Center itself. We have four poets: Loy Ledbetter, Mary Ann DeGrandpre Kelly, whose name gets longer and longer every time I see it, Marie Shue Elliott, and then Robert Nazarene. Our first poet tonight is Loy Ledbetter. Loy Ledbetter retired from Ralston Purina after 36 years in branch plant management and commodity buying. He earned a degree in mechanical engineering from the University of Colorado and had 1.5 years of graduate business study. His involvement in nonprofit volunteer work has spanned more than 50 years. He currently is on the financial advisory board at Manor Grove Home in Kirkwood. He has won prizes for his art photography. His interest in the St. Louis Poetry Center covers more than 25 years. He presently holds the position of President Emeritus of the St. Louis Poetry Center, and I don't think you'll find a more loyal and hardworking supporter of poetry than Mr. Loy Ledbetter.
Is this high enough?
I can make it higher.
Well, can you hear me? You're sitting right in front. Of course you can hear me. I don't have to follow it around, do I?
Okay. All right, let's try to read.
Okay, thank you. Thank you all for coming, and from the Poetry Center, we want to thank Richard for inviting us to participate in his Dust reading series. The first poem I'm not going to give any preamble to, because I think it'll be obvious as we go along. Orange is the color of spring. Orange springs up everywhere. Reed-like cones line a road, stiff as sentinels seeking orders. Squat barrels huddled in groups, fresh from winter's hibernation, pose impending fright for future trips when they rearrange in patterns that force the skill of do-si-dos to clear the maze. Witch hats brew an orange concoction of confusion, forcing you right when you want left, left when you plan to travel straight. Beware the orange warning, work zone next 3 miles. Rushing civilization collapses into a centipede crawl, vision blocked by a truck's back door, perspective squeezed. A tide engulfs you in an elastic creep, flowing and stopping and ebbing, trapping you in your glass and steel pod. Suddenly you break free, breathe, like coming up for air from a deep dive, but your breath stops short in mid-draw. In the near distance, in mocking orange, left lane closed ahead. Adrenaline wells to fever heights. Your baser nature takes control and thrusts you on a race to be first. I'm going to have to get this closer. My glasses don't go this far. While we're on the subject of highways, this was a sign I saw along the highway, and that's the title of the poem, Nowhere Bar and Grill. I negotiate the right angles to oblivion with a trapezoidal fear. I maneuver arcs in wild positions, trying to form a circle that never closes. I worry along an elliptical path in the time warp that tomorrow is today, and that there are more dimensions than I can hold in my hand. Sciences string me along with theories that deep darkness traps most energy, explaining why I collapse without ideas before I complete the circle and realize I never left square one to arrive at nowhere. I sit at the bar in nowhere, not being, counting rings to infinity on the glossy top, moving up one stool at a time to the end. If I were somewhere, would I be being? Are the other faces that drift through the room not being too, not being also? Their shallow eyes transfixed on a wide screen, snowy with endless pixels, beamed directly for nowhere. Their ears tuned to the drone of sound effects. New faces come through the door each day, but the room never seems to crowd over. A shift change on the way to elsewhere. The coat. She denies the three-quarter coat ill fits, even though it will brush her shoe at each step, or that the shoulders droop to her arms, or the pockets overwhelm her kneecaps. She tells you she bought a bargain, too good to pass up. Brown cloth with dark piping, gold buttons, is not really my color or style. But look, with that, she reaches a thumb and forefinger, grab the collar, lift it at an askew angle, her head cocked left, the label appears YSL, Yvesse St. Laurent. She swooshes along like a waif in Big Sister's clothes, sweating when the weather turns too warm. When friends mention any coat, she beams and launches into the collar-tugging routine. By the end of the season, as the label appears behind her ear, the Y is smudged black. People try to decipher the SL as Sue Lyons, or as one wag says after surveying the length, so long. But quizzically she asks, don't you know that label? This next one was triggered by an article in the New York Times, I guess about a year ago. A very bizarre story. A man served a number of years for rape, and when he got out of prison, he and the victim married. And the article sort of surmised that maybe the reason they were together, stayed together, was they both loved notoriety. And so that got me to thinking, okay, why do some couples stay together? And this is a mental marital dialogue. Now, on the written page, you can tell who's talking, but I'm going to say he and she when the time comes. Relativity. A sailor drops a stone from a mast on a ship heading out to sea. Does a rock fall at the base of the mast or a few feet back? A man watching from a dock perceives it to fall farther back, while the sailor sees it land at the base. Einstein said they are both right. It depends on their relative stance. He, did last night's quarrel fall dead at our feet? Or did it land in the space between us? She, or did it explode into a thousand fractured syllables that float far above our reach? He, you're like water before the wind, twisting and twirling, roiled in anger by the message the wind sends forth, dizzy from the swirling, rising to foam with a discordant fury that throws itself obliquely in all directions. crashing with a blindness against objects obstructing its path, collapsing finally into an ebbing flow. She, you rub the fuzzy edges of romance to a nubbin, pick strand by strand, twist each thread between your fingers, wrapping their length into a tight knot until you warp the fabric shapeless, and then decry the lost appearance. He, your weather outlook casts sunny with only a few scattered clouds, but as the day progresses, the undersides turn dark, strewing the cotton puffs into a furious roll, a storm that lashes out in multiplex, forcing me to seek shelter, a lee of anything. See, I glide into the day on a sunbeam, wearing the freshness of a beginning like a new coat, wrapped in comfort, but my words bounce off the wall, find no home except the table's top, the windowsill, and bare floor. You hide in plain sight, impervious to my offerings. Ignore anything but your own encompassing shell until the impasse becomes intolerable. My relief valve blows and sends a screaming head of steam into space. He. Your raucous laugh that's filled with grief, the soundings you daily take with urchins, artists, and people on the go, stir up a heat, a feast of unexpected taste, but my expectations have settled in to accept the constant state of flux. She. Though you derive comfort behind your buffer, your stoic silence suspends me in midair, but your presence is reassuring, like a Buddha made of stone that sits always in its niche. The next poem is the result of sitting in very early morning as the dawn starts and listening to the sounds. This is called The Break at Day. There is a stillness after the night ones have ceased their marauding, and before the day creatures come awake, when a scuffy gray swipes the sky with the first pastels, when the lake swirls whiffs, offering up to the air, when the wind sends feeble fingers to test the mood of the water, time balances, deciding whether to move forward or drop back. But the tentative croak of a frog announces that the day is moving on. A louder response, the harbinger of a hummingbird whirring past, and a babble of sounds that soon arise claim the place in the order. I steel myself for the first chug of motor and the whine of a mechanical gobbler. Starlings. Starlings in the sky by thousands, swinging through the air in an elastic bunch, hordes rising, hordes sliding in descent, black spots plaguing a cornfield for lunch. Starlings, the first two someone transposed to these shores, were a good-natured joke. Today, somewhere up there in gentle repose, Alfred Hitchcock is waving his baton a stroke. Then I'll end with this poem. This was written for a friend of mine who died a few months ago. He was a fighter pilot in the Navy in World War II and flew Corsairs. This is the last flight for Jack. The Corsair sits on the flight deck for weeks awaiting the last takeoff, while the pilot languishes in the ready room. The day arrives. He climbs into the cockpit, revs the engine. When the colored flags flash go, the plane lurches forward, sails off the end of the deck, and climbs gently. It circles old neighborhoods, salutes with a waggle of wings, friends watching below, glides over familiar traces, then ascends to a height that looks back over two oceans, climbs higher and higher until it is a dot in the sky, and soon disappears, but leaves behind indelible vapor trails.